I'm glad to see you all found that the reading was not at the Poetry Center, as was announced in the newspaper. We'll be having punch and cookies tonight at the Student Union. I hope you can all come. If you haven't met Miss Gallagher, it'll be a chance for you to say hello. Several people called last week, rather upset that we didn't have a reading. I can assure you that the next three Wednesdays, there are readings. And then we get one more week off, and the last reading will be November 28th. Next week's reader is Robert Pack, comes to us from Middlebury, Connecticut, and he is, Vermont, excuse me, Middlebury, Vermont, and he's the director of the Breadloaf Writers Conference, and that will be on Halloween, which is why we have a pumpkin-colored announcement for him. I am, as usual, looking for news for the next newsletter. If you're too shy to tell me what nice things have happened to you, get one of your friends to do it. Tess Gallagher read for us in 1977 as a visiting poet, and we're very happy to have her here now as a member of our creative writing faculty. Her books are Instructions to the Double, Under Stars, and Stepping Outside. Her work appears in many anthologies and many poetry magazines. In addition to her poetry writing, she is also a columnist for the American Poetry Review. We're very happy to have her read for us tonight, Miss Tess Gallagher.
I'd like to start by thanking students and those of you, the mothers of students, even who saw that I got a welcome here in Tucson, a student who followed from El Paso, people who contributed card tables and toasters and plants and have helped me get settled here. When I came here in 1977, I was coming from Port Angeles, Washington, which is where I was born. And I'll begin with a poem that I wrote for my father, which is in Instructions to the Double. It's kind of a portrait of this town. The black money mentioned it has to do with how the money in his pockets was turned black by working in the sulfur pyramids that they use to refine paper. Yeah, we lived right up the hill from a pulp mill. His lungs heaving all day in a sulfur mist, then dusk, the lunch pail torn from him before he reaches the house, his children, a cloud of swallows about him. At the stove in the tumbled rooms, the wife, her back, the wall he fights most, and she with no weapon but silence and to keep him from the bed. In their sleep, the mill hums and turns at the edge of water. Blue smoke swells the night, and they drift from the graves they have made for each other, float out from the open-mouthed sleep of their children, past banks and businesses, the used car lot, liquor store, the swings in the park. The mill burns on, now a burst of cinders, now whistles screaming down the bay, saws jagged in half-light. Then, like a whip, the sun across the bed, windows high with mountains, and the sleepers fall into pillows as gulls fall, tilting against their shadows on the log booms. Again, the trucks shutter the wood-framed houses, passing to the mill. My father snorts, splashes in the bathroom, throws open our doors to cowboy music. On the radio, hearts are cheating. Somebody is alone. There's blood in Tulsa. Out the backyard, the night shift men rattle the gravel in the alley going home. My father fits goggles to his head. From his pocket, he takes anything metal, the pearl-handled jackknife, a ring of keys, and for us, black money shoveled from the sulfur pyramids heaped in the distance like yellow gold. Coffee bottle tucked in his armpit, he swaggers past the chicken coop, a pack of cards at his breast. In a fan of light beyond him, the Kino Maru pulls out for Seattle, some black star climbing the deep globe of his eye. To go now to a poem written while I was in El Paso, I spent the last half of my Guggenheim down there on the border. And I was living in a kind of suburban neighborhood. In fact, I had my first introduction to the 20th century, I think, officially. I had a dishwasher even, which I told my students cut down on my singing, and so I got to resent it a little bit. I had a neighbor that I didn't meet until about the second week that I was there, and she made a great effort to come out in the backyard and meet me. It's called Some with Wings, Some with Manes. Over the stone wall, her hand comes, each knuckle enlarged to a miniature skull. She reaches into my rented yard to call me neighbor. Sunlight dazzles her spectacles, and in the chromium glint of her walker, she is bright royalty on an errand of magnitude, an effort to stand, an effort to step the pain carefully around invisible parameters, and still to say effort is nobility. Her hands are perfectly good for pointing. That small bare tree near my walkway, if pruned, would be heavy with peaches the size of your fist by July. In new regard, I think what it could and will do. Then, not to demean its offering, keep the next thought that I'll be gone by summer. She has the name of a workhorse I knew in Missouri, Dolly, and has outlived a sister to the same disease. She sat down with it, and that was the end of her. Such variations on reluctance caused me to see a kite, stubborn in a childhood pear tree, still a bash in the wind with its complication of branches. I sighted my days by its banners until the tree caressed it into flight one day I wasn't looking. For didn't the memory of the tree go with it, the shred of it? Less articulate by then, a slip of motion, longing to wrap itself in a tattered lunge at the whole air. After that, the tree said only the same thing other trees say before coming to fruit. Somehow we knew in our child hearts when a thing is ruined not to meddle with ecstasy by setting it free. We left it, though it ruffles the mind yet. Sitting in the darkened afternoon of her living room, I hear the death of the only daughter. Meet the husband who loves eggs and sweets, says little. I'm the last of my family, she says. Then in the walker leads me down the grassy corridor to a room sleeping like a princess. The spell I see is in the elaborate coverlet. She will teach me how to do it. It took me 14 months of evenings, the hands now going out to the stitched pieces, remembering they have done this. I know I will never do it. We'll be gone by summer. What is it called? Cathedral windows, she says, and the raised light of her hands falls over me. Well, I didn't know whether to show this poem to her or not. One day I came home with my sack of groceries and she was sitting out in the carport and she said, come over here. And I came over and she said, I have something for you. She sent her husband into the house and her husband came out. She says, I've made you a pattern of cathedral windows. And she has it all pinned together here. So I thought, well, I guess I'd better show her this poem. So I said, well, I have something for you too. And I went back and I got it. And by then another neighbor of ours had come over and was standing in the carport. And I was then very embarrassed because she said, well, would you read it to me? And so I gave my first carport poetry reading in Texas. And the woman across the street wanted a copy of it. It was a really wonderful experience. I think maybe we should have more of them. But I was afraid the husband would be insulted by his part in the poem, but he seemed pleased too. The next poem is a little, well, you know how you have objects sometimes that get endowed with magic, with such special significance, and you don't know how they exactly got that way. Well, and even things that belong to other people, sometimes this happens to me, that I get attached to things that other people have in a certain way that maybe they're not even attached. This is called I Save Your Coat, But You Lose It Later. It was a coat worth keeping, even with you in no condition to keep track, your mind important to things you were seeing out the window. We had changed seats on the bus so a little breeze could catch our faces. The coat was back there in a spot of sunlight, its leather smell making a halo of invitation around it. We got off near the planetarium and were heading for stars. Just to make one eye do the work of two and bring back ghost light was making us forgetful. Then I looked at you, strange without your coat, which I knew you loved and had paid an incredible price for, as if you had tried to buy something that would make you sorry. The bus was whirring itself into traffic, its passengers locked into destinations. I ran with everyone until they stopped in their seats. There was your coat, a big interruption in everybody's destination. When I picked it up, it scalded my hand like an unbearable red I saw once on a woman coming toward me. We had a 40-year reunion right there on the street, as if the coat had met us again in its afterlife. We were that glad, hugging it between us. Then you put it on and checked yourself in the store window, wearing yourself those moments to see forgiveness take your shape, then catching in the light of those walking through you. I suppose it was gratitude, you're wearing it with telescopes, me putting my hand in your pocket, pretending to rob you while you looked for the first time at the four moons of Jupiter. Some weeks later, you write your coat was stolen after a long night of drinking and music. They took all your money. You never saw it again. I am in a state of mourning for your coat, which traveled with us that while, like a close relative concealing a fatal illness in the last visit. I remember a heart doctor who saved a man for 10 hours so his wife disappeared into hope and would not come back and would not take her lips from his until they wheeled him away. I make too much of this. Your coat, which, stolen or lost, did not belong to me, which I never wore. Yeah, I'm not only fond of coats, I'm fond of shirts. And the next poem is called The Shirts. It's a love poem. Sometimes you try to write a love poem to many men. This is a love poem to many men. The Shirts. They would be shamed to see back at us, themselves among the others. I have done this, have hung them side by side. Did I ask this or did they come to me? And what can it mean that I keep their shapes without them? They are all colors and one has thin stripes with lavender. My hands from the sleeves are another's, reminding. And the small, exact musculature of his arms takes on my body. When I left, he said, "Take this until I see you next." Much later, he would tell her name, the woman who bought it. Its changed face where my breasts force out, and the one thought, our size, the same. The green one, like the moss light of lovers on the forest floor, its shoulders too broad, the collar sharp with intention. Flannel, the fur of winter, fires that light up the forehead and cast the eyes in shadow. In it, I am the young girl whose protector fills her with dread and does not return. It's caution. Don't wear this when you meet her. This one is blue, and the man of it had eyes like that. Blue, I said, send me some good books. I want to know how you think. He had a lot of shirts like this one. When I took it, he could not miss it as the special one. Only this have I given back, the red one, the one with a blotch of pitch that would not wash out. Fire shirt of the question, will it end? Man with a passion to burn his love out in me, nightly, daily, the white hot tongs of love. He wears it to breakfast, wants pure maple syrup. He likes the pitcher full. He can stand the sweetness. The next poem is a kind of story poem. I've been seeing that I can follow out voices if I can get them started. Little animated scenes. I don't know where they're going often. I just follow them out. And this one, in it, I have the scene in my head that two women are meeting, and they haven't known one another in a long while, and one of them's had a very turbulent life in which she's still living in, and the other one has perhaps lived more, quote, normally. It's called Second Sleep. We had been gone a long while, though she had written once or twice. They say your man keeps guns, I said. She bent her head, then looked out over the water. The war, you know, she said, as I knew you before. I said you would have called yourself out of this. That woman, I've seen her, she said, and fastened the throat of her shirt. She came often in the first months. Don't come in, I told her. All the guns are loaded in this house. Once she came close to the window so that I got the drawer of his desk open. The metal was cold to my hand. I went with her. It was only after we'd walked deep into the sword ferns that she turned and I saw the perfect blood bead on her brow. She walked back to me the way you walk back to a child that doesn't trust where you're going. She lifted my hand to the wet pit. "There," she said, "there." Her look was sure. She took the fingers one by one and sucked them dry. Sometimes he asks about it. That gun he can't find. I can't account for it. He thinks I sold it for some pleasure, secret I've kept from him, or given it to a lover, the one who will break in on us like a wronged husband and kill us naked in our bed. He sleeps with his clothes on. Often he dresses me in my sleep. I woke this morning in my furs, the black seal which may not be worn in public. "Wake up," I said. I felt so tender for him. I opened the coat. I lay on top of him. His work shirt smelled of pitch and beer. "There's only you," I said, all the time thinking it could be done. I could do it myself, even loving him. I took off his clothes. I woke him a little while. Later, in my second sleep, I could hear him knocking at the baseboards. "Where is it?" he says. "You must know." I get up in my fur coat. I get down on my knees on the wood floor. "I don't," I tell him. It is the right thing to be missing. We keep looking, turning over the house, and I am full of pity and love for him. All this to make a fear that would keep us. Could you love a man like that? Where have you been all these years? When I was making my way back to poetry in about 1970 after living 5 years in the South, I began to work for a blind man, and I worked very long days with him, 10-hour days. We worked for the police department in Seattle, Washington. And it was a very fine apprentice for a poet because you had to develop great powers of empathy to think what he would need. And after we'd worked some time together, he asked one day if he could feel my face, if he could see what I looked like. And I said he could. Just the hands of the blind man. In the square room, without windows, where the hours fill our pockets with soft money, you reach for simple things, the circle of ash, the cup, its warm liquid eye, the telephone, its knowing that voices are always blind. Walking from work, you wave fire past your cigarette. There is the hand of a stranger. Now the muzzles of dogs, the rain. Touching my face once, you were the rain, the stranger. Yet never did anyone in the dark leave hands on me as you. We'll go back to Instructions to the Double for a moment and read a poem about that has a horse in it. I want to introduce a recent poem which has a horse in it. This was written in St. Lawrence University, about 18 miles from St. Lawrence River, upstate New York. Loss of snow. And the title, consequently, is Snow Heart. Don't need to be worried in this poem about following it in a real narrative sense. It's more like a song. You just have to kind of leap with it. In our houses, the snow keeps us traveling. It says your life is where you are. The phone all day ringing by itself over the next lot isn't for you. The man with the perfect haircut makes a track across the lawn, holding his books like a breast. Snowheart, you have said, don't cut your black hair. Love's the only debt. He's up again and riding the best mare 10 miles by moonlight, the spruce-backed fiddle under his arm. Dance us the next one, too. If day comes, don't tell. Let the horse go home alone. Snowheart, someone's horse circles the near house. There is snow on its back. This is a new poem that Michael Cudahy's going to publish in Ironwood, called From Dread in the Eyes of Horses. I think it might help you to know that the Ridge of Yellow Horses is a place where a Russian stumbled onto a band of horses that were still in the prehistoric state. I got to reading about horses, and I found out that the Arabs love their young foals so much that they bring them right into the house, and they're in the charge of women. So I got some imaginings going about this, and I think that's what the poem grows out of. Also, some childhood experiences with horses. My grandfather raised horses and was a great horse trader down in Missouri in the Ozarks. I spent my childhood summers down there. And I always used to marvel at how you would go get the horses, and my uncle would insist on riding them around the field before he would let any of the children, any of his children, get up there on the horse's backs. And I said, well, why do you get to ride first? I wanted to ride the horse first. And he said, well, it hasn't been ridden in a few days. And this way in which horses got wild so quickly is if they hadn't been ridden in even 1 or 2 days, the way they would go back to that wildness. From Dread in the Eyes of Horses. Eggs, dates, and camel's milk. Give this. In 1 hour, the foal will stand. In 2, will run. The care, then, of women. The schooling from fear. Clamor of household. A prospect of saddles. They kneel to it, folded on its 4 perfect legs. Stroke the good back. The muscles bunched at the chest. Its head, how the will shines large in it as what may be used to overcome it. The women of the horses comb out their cruel histories of hair only for the pleasure of horses, for the lost mares on the ridge of yellow horses, their white arms praying the hair down breasts ordinary as knees. The extent of their power, this intimation of sexual wealth, from Dread in the Eyes of Horses are taken their songs. In the white forest, the last free horses eat branches and roots, are hunted like deer, and carry no one. A wedge of light where the doorway opens the room, in it a sickness of sleep, the arms of the women, their coarse white hair. In a bank of sunlight, a man whitewashes the house he owns, no shores, no worlds above it, and farther, shrill, obsidian, the high feasting of the horses. I had an unfortunate thing happen before I got here, in that my house was vandalized. It was the oddest housewarming one could expect. It was the first house that I ever owned, and so I felt really undone by this aspect of ownership, and so I've been trying to cheer this house up ever since, and I had a young man helping me paint. He got there very early in the morning, at about 5:30 or 6 in the morning, and was painting while I was still asleep, and the notion of his paintbrush going against the house while I was still asleep got me into this poem. It's called Willingly. When I get up, he has been long at work, his brush limber against the house before sunrise. Seeing him on his ladder under the eaves, I look back on myself asleep in the dream I could not carry awake. Sleep inside a house that is being painted, whole lifetimes now, only the familiar cast of morning light over the prayer plant, as if to say, this is something new, of where you have been. What was settled or unsettled in sleep stays there, but your house under his steady arm is leaving itself, and you see that the surface of new light covering gradually your sleep has the greater power. You think now you felt brush strokes or the space between them, a motion bearing down on you like an accumulation of stars, each night of them arranging over the roofs of entire cities. His careful strokes whiten the web, the swirl of wood grain that will be blotted out like a breath stopped at the heart. Nothing has changed, you say, faithlessly, but something has cleansed you past recognition. When you stand near his ladder looking up, he does not acknowledge you, and you see, as from daylight in a dream, your house has passed from you into the blessed hands of others. This is ownership, you think, arriving in the heady afterlife of paint smell. A deep opening goes on in you. Some paint has dropped onto your shoulder as though light concealed an unsuspected weight. You think it has fallen through you. You think you have agreed to this, what has been done with your life, willingly. Next poem is a poem I want to read because I like how it changes its mind. It starts out to be just another one of these romantic love poems. To ask the imagination to save it, you know. And then it lives it out the way it is. It's called Painted Steps. I was coming down the wide painted steps. I wanted to go with you in your leaving the way a farmer would go behind his horse to keep the rows straight. Even when we reached the car door and I knew the field would not get there in time, I thought surely he'll find a way to walk from this so I can see him harmed and unsure, like a man who would turn back if he could, if the field were not coming late under its flock of birds. The last moments when you leaned from the car, even then I thought, if only we could believe this as never, the field would have mercy, would come down around us like a fine healing rain. I stood where the car had been and looked out as far as I could, believing so the light would deepen and drop off the field, empty and settle one patch of sky. But no, I'm not one of those who changes an ending to keep the moment true. Think of me as one who lives things quickly, cruelly, as a car could live it. Think of me as one who stands in the streets, speeding past with a stopped wheel in my hands and the radio, its small hearth flickering along the trees ahead. Go back to Texas here for a minute. I went out for dinner with three women one night, and we had a male waiter. I want to say that I spent a long apprenticeship as a waitress, and so my attitude toward the waiter here comes from that, knowing how he felt. Called Crepes Flambeau. We are three women eating out in a place that could be California or New Jersey, but is Texas, and our waiter says his name is Jerry. He is pink and young, dressed in soft denim with an embroidered vest, and my friend says a nice butt. It's hard not to be intimate in America, where your waiter wants you to call him Jerry. So why do you feel sorry for him standing over the flames of this dessert? The little fans of the crepes are folding into the juice. The brandy is a flare in a low blue hush and golden now and red where he spills the brown sugar saved to make our faces wear the sudden burst. We are all good-looking and older, and he has to please us or try to. What could go wrong. Too much brandy, too little sugar, fire falling into our laps, fire like laughter behind his back, even when he has done it just right. Jerry, we say, that was wonderful. For now he is blushing at us like a russet young girl. Our lips are red with fire and juice. He knows we could go on eating long into the night until the flames run down our throats. Thank you, he says, handing us our check, knowing among the ferns and napkins that he has pleased us briefly, like all good things, dying away at the only moment before we are too happy, too glad in the pioneer decor, rough boards, spotted horses in the frame. The next one has a kind of ironic title because it's spoken by someone who's dead, and it's called Tableau Vivant, or living scene. They think it's easy to be dead, those who walk the pathway here in stylish shoes, portable radios strapped to their arms, selling the world's perishables, even love songs. They think you just lie down into dreams you will never tell anyone. They don't know we still have plans, a yen for romance, and miss things like hats and casseroles. As for dreams, we take up where the living leave off. We like especially those in which the dreamer was about to fall over a cliff or from a bridge that is falling too. We're only too glad to look down on the river gorge, enlarging under a body's sudden weight, to have the ground rushing up instead of this slow caving in. We thrive on living out the last precious memories of someone escaped back into morning light. Occasionally there's a message saying they want one of us back, someone out there feeling guilty about a word or deed that seems worse because we took it as a living harm, then died with it quietly. But we know a lot about forgiveness, and we always make these trips with a certain missionary zeal. We get back into our old sad clothes. We stand again at the parting, full of wrong tenderness and needing a shave or a hairdo. We tell them things are okay, not to waste their lives in remorse. We never held it against them. So much happens that no one means. But sometimes one of us gets stubborn, an idea of evening the score. We leave them calling after us, sorry, 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 and we don't look back. The next poem was written during the first half of my Guggenheim when I was living in a cabin up in the in Port Townsend, where the editor of Grey Wolf Press, the press that publishes me, is. It's about an hour from where I was born. I had a lot of teasing about my living circumstances out there because the cabin wasn't winterized, and I had to spend a lot of my time cutting alder, which burns all too fast. All I had was a fireplace and a cook stove. And so my friends down there said, well, you're just wasting this Guggenheim money. You're just chopping wood all the time. And so I teased them after I wrote this poem, because I said, well, if I hadn't had a wood house, I never would have gotten this poem. It's called Bird Window Flying. I got that title, I think, from reading David Wagner's poems taken from Indian myths. If we had been given names to love each other by, I would take this one from you, bird flying all day in my woodhouse. The door is open as when you came to it, into it as space between branches. Never trust doors, you tell the window, the small of your body flung against the white bay. At dusk, when I walked in with my armload of green alder, I could see the memory of light shining water through your wings, you were gray with it. The window had aged you with promises. I thought the boats, the gulls, should have stilled you by now. When I cupped my hands in their shadows, warm over the heart wings, I saw the skin of light between my fingers, haloed and glowing. 3 steps I took with you, for you, 3 light years traveling to your sky, beak and claw of you, the soft burr of flight at my finger bones. If I take a lover for every tree, I will not have again such an opening as when you flew from me. I have gone in to build my fire. All the walls, all the wings of my house are burning, the flames of me, the long hair unbraiding. I'm going to go now to poems from Under Stars. You know, sometimes you write a poem to finish an argument, and this is, you always get the best of it that way. I had a lot of disagreements with Irish women. They thought that American women were emasculating their men, and that was the only thing that we were up to. And I wasn't able to convince her otherwise. So she had me meet her down at this place that was later blown up by the IRA in Sligo. It's one of these businessmen's hotels. On your own. How quickly the postures shift. Just moments ago, we seemed human, or in the Toledo of my past, I made out I was emotionally illiterate, so as not to feel a pain I deserved. Here at the Great Southern, some of the boys have made it into gray suits and pocket calculators. I'm feeling end of season, like a somebody who's hung around the church between a series of double weddings. Friend, what you said about the terror of American womanhood, I forget it already. But I know what you mean. I'm so scary some days I'd run from myself. It's hard work having your way, even half the time, and having it know what not to do with it. Who hasn't thrown away a life or two at the mercy of another's passion, spite, or industry? It's like this on your own. The charms unlucky, the employment solitary, the best love always the benefit of a strenuous doubt. The next poem is a poem that did appear in Ironwood, Ballad of Ballymote. Ballymote is in the west of Ireland. It's near, not too far from the border between the Republic of Ireland and the North of Ireland. People wonder why I put this poem in the West of Ireland, in the Republic, rather than in the North. And I think it was because I felt more fear of when I was in the Republic than I felt in the North. People couldn't even afford to be afraid up there sometimes, because they had to live with it all the time. But the people near the border were afraid. It's also a portrait of the situation of Irish women quite a lot. The Ballad of Ballymote. We stopped at her hut on the road to Ballymote, but she did not look up, and her head was on her knee. What is it, we asked. As from the dreams of the dead, her voice came up. My father, they shot him as he looked up from his plate, and again as he stood, and again as he fell against the stove, and like a thrush his breath bruised the room and was gone. A traveler would have asked directions, but saw she would not lift her face. What is it? He asked. My husband sits all day in a pub and all night, and I may as well be a widow for the way he beats me to prove he's alive. "What is it?" asked the traveler's wife, just come up to look. "My son's lost both eyes in a fight to keep himself a man, and there he sits behind the door where there is no door, and he sees but the stumps of his hands. And have you no daughters for comfort? Two there are and gone to nuns, and a third to the north with a fisherman. What are you cooking?" "Cabbage and bones," she said, "cabbage and bones." I was last in Ireland in May, and I have a growing interest now in traditional Irish music, which has been going on since before I visited here in 77. This last trip, we went down into County Fermanagh, which is on the northern side, with places like Enniskillen, names like that. And I was traveling with these musicians, singers. See, there were two singers in the group, and a flute player, and a woman fiddle player, which is kind of unusual because the women aren't very much even on the traditional Irish music scene. And these songs have become very important to me. I've started to collect a certain variety of them, a variety called that I called my ghost songs. So I would ask all of these singers if they knew any ghost songs. I had my tape recorder along, and I would record these songs from them. And I have a feeling they've affected some of the voice quality in some of the poems. I want to introduce the next poem with a song. These songs are not sung with any accompaniment. They're usually you've had a few pints, and someone has got the voice going, saying, "Well, let's have a song. And usually you probably had several fiddle tunes. I can remember one evening being in a room with 15 fiddle players, if you can imagine. So this is one of the ghost songs. It's sung by a woman named Diane Keane, and it's called "There Was a Maid." There was a maid in her father's garden, and a gentleman came passing by. He stopped a while, and he stood and watched her. Then he said, "Fair maid, will you marry me? I am no lady, but a poor girl, and a poor girl of low degree. And so, young man, you must find another, for I'm not fitting your bride-to-be. Oh, I have houses, and I have money, and I have land to set you free. I'll make you a fine young lady, and you'll have servants to wait on thee. 7 years since I had a sweetheart, and 7 more since I did him see. 7 more I will wait upon him, for he's the young man that I love best. It's 7 years since you had a sweetheart, and 7 more since you did him see. 7 more you will wait upon him, for he's the young man that you love best. If he's sick, I wish him better, and if he's dead, I wish him rest. If he's alive, he'll come home to me, for he's the young man that I love best." He put his hand into his pockets, his lily white fingers being small and thin, and out between them he took a gold ring, and when she saw it, down she did fall. He picked her up all in his arms and gave her kisses most tenderly, saying, I'm your true love, a single sailor, come home from sea, love, to wed with thee. If you're my true love, a single sailor, your face and features seem strange to me, but 7 years makes great alterations on the raging sea between you and me. Well, sometimes it's the dead one doesn't come back so willingly, and you have to call him back. And so this poem is one in which the speaker raises the dead. It's called The Ritual of Memories. When your widow had left the graveside and you were most alone, I went to you in that future you can't remember yet. I brought a basin of clear water where no tear had fallen, water gathered like grapes, a drop at a time from the leaves of the willow. I brought oils. I brought a clean white gown. Come out, I said, and you came up like a man pulling himself out of a river. A river with so many names, there was no word left for it but earth. Now, I said, I'm ready. These eyes that have not left your face since the day we met, wash these eyes. Remember, it was a country road above the sea, and I was passing from the house of a friend. Look into these eyes where we met. I saw your mind go back through the years, searching for that day. And finding it, you washed my eyes with the pure water, so that I vanished from that road, and you passed a lifetime, and I was not there. So you washed every part of me where any look or touch had passed between us. Remember, I said, when you came to the feet, it was the night before you had asked the girl of your village to marry. I was the strange one. I was the one with the gypsy look. Remember how you stroked these feet. When the lips and the hands had been treated likewise, and the pit of the throat where one thoughtless kiss had fallen, you rubbed in the sweet oil, and I glistened like a new-made thing, not merely human, but of the world gone past being human. The hair, I said, you've forgotten the hair. Don't you know it remembers? Don't you know it keeps everything? Listen, there is your voice, and in it the lyre's charm that caught me. You listened, you heard your voice, and a look of such sadness passed over your dead face that I wanted to touch you. Who could have known I would be so held? Not you in your boyish cunning, not me in my traveler's clothes. It's finished. Put the gown on my shoulders. It's no life in the shadow of another's joys. Let me go freely now. One life I have lived for you, this one is mine. I think I'll finish with a poem from my father, and kind of round out things since I started with him. I had just come back from Ireland in 1977, and my father had had a heart attack while I was away, and I wasn't able to be there for very long. And he was still continuing, as he always had, going down and playing cards at the Chinook Tavern until 2 in the morning. And then my job would be to go down and get him, bring him home, and we'd sit up and sober up, have some coffee. I'd make him some eggs sometimes, and we would have serious talks at that hour of the morning. And because I was going away the next day, he seemed to want to try and tell me a lot of things about his life. But also he was very merciful and also leaving out things. He had come up there in 1940 to the Northwest and had been logging with my mother. They were partners. She was a choker setter for him. And then he went to longshoring after that. 3 a.m. kitchen, my father talking. For years, it was land working me, oil fields, cotton fields. Then I got some land. I worked it. Them days you could just about make a living. I was logging. Then I sent to Missouri. Mama come out. We got married. We got some kids, 5 kids. That kept us going. We bought some land near the water. It was cheap then. The water was right there. You just looked out the window. It never left the window. I bought a boat, 14-footer. There was fish out there then. You remember, we used to catch 6, 8 fish, clean them right out in the yard. I could have fished to China. I quit the woods one day, just walked out, took off my corks, said, that's it. I went to the docks. I was driving winch. You had to watch to see nothing fell out of the sling. If you killed somebody, you'd never forget it. All those years, I was just working. I was on edge every day, just working. You kids, I could tell you a lot, but I won't. It's winter. I play a lot of cards down at the tavern. Your mother, I have to think of excuses to get out of the house. You're wasting your time, she says. You're wasting your money. You don't have no idea, Threesy. I run out of things to work for. Hell, why shouldn't I play cards? Threesy, some days now, I just don't know. Thank you very much.